right, everybody. I guess it's a good time to start. 5 minutes afterwards, it's like Christchurch time or something. very glad to see you all here. I'm sure this will be a fascinating presentation. It's my pleasure to introduce Jake Bacchus, Managing Director of Empathy Sustainability, and formerly Customer Sustainability Director and Commercial Leadership Manager for Coca-Cola Europe, and also a visiting senior member of Lineker College here at Oxford. And Made Sitwan, an agroecologist from Bali who has a master's in medical anthropology from the University of Amsterdam and a PhD from U of Illinois, School of Public Health, a global citizen. Made lives in Oxford and has worked with the world's largest Red Plus project with indigenous communities looking at viable alternatives to logging and mining and the avoidance of forest fires. So without further ado, turn over the floor.
Thank you very much.
So I'll kick things off just to give a bit of context, and I'll move really quickly because I think what I'm going to describe is background, and you pretty much know most of that. So we'll spend as much time as we can listening to Made, who's pretty fascinating person and always has an incredible amount of insights. So just to kick things off, so as we know, deforestation is one of the biggest causes of climate change. It causes about 10% of global emissions, and 80% of that is industrial agriculture and agribusiness and on monoculture. Soy, beef, cattle, paper and pulp, etc. And one of the big issues around that is there's a huge and incredible loss of biodiversity and ecosystems and habitats. Also, the local and indigenous people then start to get left out of the equation. They don't have decent jobs to go for, or they're working for remote, large companies, often based in a different country, so they are then marginalised. I mean, even Oxfam's paper, or Oxfam's website on their collaboration with PepsiCo for fair company community engagement has 15 mentions of human rights. So what's being done about this massive loss of forest and degradation and forest degradation? A number of initiatives. Some are like the round table on sustainable palm oil, so looking at supply chain approach. So those key supply chains start to have sustainable round tables in order to have responsible sourcing of those materials. There's also the round table for sustainable soy, and also they have commitments for NDPE, so no deforestation, no peat, and no exploitation. So the Consumer Goods Forum has about 400 companies made up of manufacturers and retailers in 70 countries around the world. In 2010, they made a pledge to stop deforestation. So we're now 1.5 years away, and they're not going to get there. It's really not working. So the whole concept of doing no harm is not taking us far enough, fast enough. So we need now to have restorative supply chains. So another type of initiative is an initiative called RED. Does anybody want to have a go at defining what RED means? Nobody? And even Red Plus. So it's a terrible acronym, and I think these kind of acronyms are exclusionary in terms of trying to support what they are actually for. So Red is reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. They have since put a plus. Say, so, oh, what's the plus mean? The plus means the bit they forgot, which is around conservation and sustainable development. But even so, these can be good, but the metrics of Red Plus conservation projects are essentially do nothing. So it's make sure, and this was actually Made's job to work, this is the largest Red Plus project in the world, if you Google it, actually Made was working for a project 3 times bigger, and his job was to work with the local indigenous people around the outside to make sure that they don't go in, setting fires, logging, reducing the water table, mining, etc. So much of the metrics of these Red Plus projects are keep the locals away and make sure the area is protected. So the big problem about that is you've got a nice piece of protected land, but what about everywhere else? So it isn't scalable, and it relies on either philanthropy or carbon pricing. And right now the global carbon price is very low. So it seems like a not very sustainable approach to scale up this whole concept. And this particular project, which I think is Rimba Raya, the primary investor was Gazprom. So being a Russian oil giant, it seems to me their investment is an offset for a harm somewhere else. So what we actually need is initiatives which have net benefits and which are scalable. And that point about, okay, you've protected this bit, what about the rest of the landscape? Okay. So it's not coming up. Okay, so this is the Rimba Raya project. So you can see sort of palm oil all around the outside. So the rest of the landscapes, there is now an approach towards integrated landscape management. So rather than take a supply chain approach, where you look at the farmers that you engage with within your own supply chain, it's a much more integrated and jurisdictional approach where you have engaged all stakeholders in the entire area, and you think, what does this landscape want to look like in 2030 or 2050? What level of development do we want? And what is the role of each person? And you manage those conflicting and the tensions between that environment, and engage smallholders and stakeholders in terms of their capability development to move the agenda forwards. And you've got things which have been quite successful, like fair trade, but even fair trade is a bit of a sort of red word or red rag word in some environments. And the need also to build capability within the regional governments. So the thing is that the people, often in this whole environment and discussions, the people left out are the indigenous and local people, left out of those global supply chain discussions, left out of all of that carbon monetization and carbon trading as a concept, and they struggle to make a living on what is not really a very profitable, cash crop. So about 40% of the palm oil in Malaysia and in Southeast Asia comes from smallholder farmers, many of which are not part of the responsible, the round table of, why are they so concerned about what the shape of the table is? I don't really know. But the round table on sustainable palm oil, they're not part of that. So they get left out, and that means it's not. We haven't really solved much of a problem. So, I think it was like last November or December. I went to a talk in Oxford by Made Setiwan, an agroecologist from Bali, talking about forest polyculture, and particularly growing vanilla in degraded rainforest. And the potential of that to allow the forest to regrow. And I thought, whoa, I used to work for the biggest purchaser of vanilla in the world. We could do this at scale. And I spoke to Maddie and said, yeah, that was his ambition, but he hasn't really got the time because he's between here and Indonesia, doing stuff on the ground, making things happen. But if I was to be, to help him, together we could actually make a project to look at forest restoration at scale. So we have set our so in Indonesia there's between 6 and 11 million hectares of degraded forest. We've set a target of restoring up to 2 million hectares of degraded forest with potentially social impact for up to 5 million people. So real vanilla is only 1% of the global vanilla market. So if we can grow vanilla from 1% of the market to 5%, so that plus 4% would represent about those 2 million hectares. And whoops, so then we would then need to say to big companies, look, don't need any money from you. You just need to buy more shade-grown, sustainable forest vanilla, and that will lead to forest regrowth, carbon capture, social impact, and stabilization of the price of vanilla. So vanilla is the second most valuable food crop in the world after saffron. So it's about $500 a kilo, and very small and portable to get it out of the forest. So based on that anchor cash crop, there's a way for farmers to grow a multiple, a number of things, and we want to prove that that's more profitable and more viable than growing palm oil or logging or going into mining. So in order to get the big companies engaged in this, we now need to prove it. Prove that there are no unintended consequences, prove that the forest does regrow, prove that there's biodiversity and there is social impact. So we now need to get some students and other people involved to go and do some research. So we have five MBA students from Side Business School looking at the economics of the supply chain, but we now need to sort of go and look at understanding what's happening locally and the opportunity to take this at scale with those big companies. Because I know who I need to talk to at Coca-Cola, I know who I need to talk to at Unilever, you know, and some, you know, Nestle and other big companies. So that's our plan. I'll hand over now to Made, who will give you much more of the detail of how this whole concept works and what we're doing about it. Thanks.
Good afternoon. So what I'm going to present is based on my my consultancy for the last 2 years with the biggest RED Plus project in the world, that is actually working on a concessions of 150,000 hectares of degraded forest. A third of it is very, very degraded, and a third of it is just started to regenerate, and the other third of it, it's still very pristine, and orangutan, gibbons, and all kinds of other big mammals, Borneo mammals, are still live there. So the idea of that working with the concessions, as Jake's already mentioned before, is solely try to tap into the carbon trade market, and how it goes right now. It's very difficult with the carbon prices getting low, and the cost of the running the projects of degraded area of 150,000 hectares, it's immense. Like for the first 5 years, they have to put up something like 70 million pound to mainly to maintain the potential fire to encroach the forest. Why fire? Because this is peat. This is very, very young peat in Kalimantan, in Borneo. That is when the water tables is low in the dry season. Just a very simple flick of a cigarette will actually create a massive forest fire. Like in my first experience working there was in July 2015. It was close to September. It was already almost the ends of the drought, and everybody was sort of like in relief. We didn't have any fire at all in our concession area. And the last 2 weeks, and some hunter went fishing with fire. I mean, we actually do fishing with fire in Borneo, because we do at Borneo Forest, peat forest, has the biodiversity where the fish is migrating inside the forest. Most of the fish in that area are air-breathing fish, so they're actually spawning and also growing inside the forest. So the last 2 weeks of the dry season, and somebody throwing somebody's probably fishing using a fire in a depressed area of the peat where fish usually congregate during the dry season, and that was about about 2,000 hectares of them gone within 2 weeks, and it's it will take probably another 15 years to actually start regenerating. So I work with the teams of forestry scientists and as well as agronomers, forest agronomer, to do a little bit of a simple experiments on what can be grown and how they are growing, as well as how it's going to enhance the community, the forest community livelihood, that will stop them encroaching into the concession area. So I was paid to work for the success of this a large concession by a big company. So the area that we're working is this site over here, this red one over here, and if you wanted to imagine what is a 150,000 hectares, it's probably close to about a third of Wales, so that's quite big. And I travel back and forth every other month, so in order to go into my campsites over there, it will take me about 4 days. From here, one night to go on a boat, one night overnight to go on a plane to Jakarta, and then to first camp, and then and boat ride and all of those things. So it's quite an intense trip for the last 2 years. So it's in the lowland. The Cuttingham project is quite a prominent project in the world. All of the big names in environments have been visiting the place, and it's been exposed to all kinds of good publicity that is actually helping the cause of conservation, peat conservation especially. I mean, this Han Solo guy came over, and then he actually, based on visiting our project, he came over on the documentary of Years Living Dangerously. You can look it up. Based on visiting our site, and our site was the concession permit was deferred all the time by the ministry over there at that time, and at the same time the forest fire was happening all the time. So Harrison Ford came around and then gave a little bit of a lecture to the Ministry of Forestry of Indonesia. I don't know how it actually went. It's been taken by the Indonesian government, but nothing much changed. You know, the government by then just keep on issuing a permit for deforestation for monoculture such as palm oil or any other monoculture system that is also considered as agroforestry, because it's next to a forest, so they call it agroforestry. So this is a little bit of a official background, what's actually happening in the area where we are working at the concession, the draining of the peat. So it's continuously going on. So the government is issuing a concession for us, for the company that I work for, to be restored and conserved. And next to the concessions, red concessions, the government issued a third of its size, about 50,000 hectares of forest to be logged as a palm oil plantation. It's a multinational palm oil plantation. So this is the site where actually we have everything going on, and the site of the landscape of the degraded area. All of these colors is indicating the reds is quite severe, and slightly the younger greens, the light greens is just about to regenerate. There's very, very little trees growing there. It's just basically fern and brackens and imbrata grass, which is what we call as the tinder of the fire, because it's so underneath it, it's peak. So in the dry season, very, very easily, when the wind is blowing from the south, so a lot of time we will have fire all over the area, and all the company has to do is just try to maintain the boundary that is safe from fire. So the company can actually easily employ the military and the police and say to guard the area from encroachment and all of this thing, but again, you know, it will cost a lot, just like employing the military to guard the biggest mine in Indonesia, copper mine in Indonesia, where it's always asking for more and more, the military and all of this private guard. So the idea of empowering the forest-based economy among the community seems to be reasonable. So that's why I was employed to try to assess what kinds of agroforestry scheme will work. So my question when I was sent over there was how forest community-based agroecology / forestry initiative will impact forest restoration and regeneration and conservation. A lot of time the question was the later one, you know, the any kinds of conservation initiative in the world, they always think that, look, we are doing the good stuff. We are doing conservation, and it should do benefit for the community. So I was looking at it with the community, and so like, what about if we do the right thing in terms of managing our own land? I think we probably will benefit these conservation efforts. And the question then raised, what is it for us? So those conservation, for example, the concession company that I work for, they got paid lots of money if the carbon market is established. So, but again, the community was asking if we're doing the right things by, you know, planting the right crops and increasing the biodiversity, who's going to measure our impact? So we will be so they will be truly benefited or justly benefited from whatever that they've been doing. So that is a burning question among the community. So they basically said, well, you know, we can't do that yet. We haven't found any right crop to plant. Maybe just for the time being, let's work with this concession company and try to learn something out of it. And so for the second question, the community then also can viewing the concession, the red concession company that is a conservationist, it's no different from any other investment in the area. You know, you're just one of the investment, either palm oil or rubber or mining. You're just one of the investment. We can, you know, extract money as much as we want, or we can give you as much as difficulty as we want. So because you're just another big people coming over here, have all of your speedboats and have all of your stuff with the uniform, so you're just another company. Well, you call yourself as a company to restore forest, but you have more money than us, and we will extract something out of you. So all the time, part of my job also try to negotiate this perceptions. So how to basically the community can go back to the first question. Let's work on your own land. And then somebody probably will one day will help you out to help them out to figure out how to get the credit that is due for them. So in my assessment, this is what's happening in the field in terms of what kind of agricultural agricultural activities is happening. So people do in Kalimantan, in Dayak, lowland and Indonesian area, people do cultivate rice. And for very, very sad reasons, or very, very, I would call it a criminal reason, the Indonesian government never considered, or I don't know whether the whole world of the rice research institution, they never really considered how sophisticated the Dayak people rice cultivation culture. For just an evidence, you know, for the evidence in the field, these people managed to develop like 68 cultivar in order to respond to any kinds of peculiarity in the environment. For example, in the community will read the community over there consider the ability to harvest rice, to grow rice, is the parameters of manhood or people's. You may be able to grow anything in the forest, but if you don't grow rice, you're less human, according to the Dayak. So they read the telltales of the environment. For example, if certain trees are flowering in a very odd season, they have a certain types of rice to correspond to that. So this is how, and the Indonesian government, we are one of the major rice eater and also rice producers, and always referring the sophistications of rice cultivations is to my culture, which is Bali and Java. I mean, I'm so ashamed as a Balinese farmer. I came from a rice-growing background. When I go to Dayak, to Kalimantan, and see how sophisticated their rice-growing culture is over there, and all of this time, we, the Javanese, Balinese, also imposing our rice-growing culture, backed by the military, of course, you know, and we're telling the Dayaks, they're like, oh, your rice-growing without irrigation is rubbish. So we'll create some kinds of a tidal-based irrigation system that completely failed. If you ever heard of this ambitious project called the Mega Rice Project in Kalimantan, in central Kalimantan, established by one of the late presidents, Suharto, in order to establish a self-sustainable rice self-sustainability in Indonesia. It's completely fair. The idea was tidal irrigation based. I don't know. You know, I don't think Suharto came up with this idea alone. I heard that World Bank is actually funding the whole project. So
that was a million hectares.
And so their idea was growing rice. Rice in the Dayak. Rice cultivation technique looks very simple and almost looks very primitive, that involves slash and burning. But actually the slash and burning is actually has all the scientific logic behind it, because the peat is so poor with nutrients, so they have their land fallow for almost up to 7 years in order to bulk up the nutrients again. And by then, most of the surrounding forests are still intact and the water table is still high. So it was fine by then, when the forest is intact, it was fine to do slash and burning, and actually will burn only about few inches of the top accumulated humus during the last 7 years. And also, it's a mechanism of fast release of phosphorus and calcium that is required by the rice, the rice. So that was fine back then. But now, the greater area of the forest is gone. The water tables is gone. Back then, you know, when they're burning, the water table is only going down less than, you know, 30 centimeters, and now it's going down up to 2 meters because of the active draining of the larger area by the palm oil or even the community too for their own purposes. So we came up with an idea that why can't we create instant forests? So I employ some fast-growing vegetation, such as which is widely used in palm oil plantation, that is called Mucuna bracteata. It's a family of legume that can grow really, really fast within 2 years. Traditionally, the farmers, the forest people will have to follow it for 7 years. But with the Mucuna bracteata, that is very invasive, high in allolepatic property that actually will smother brackens, imprata grass, or even trees the size of me. I have so many pictures how this these legumes are actually killing all of the vegetations in the designated area for rice growing. So we do have some of the experiment, and it's working, and it's being planted right now. So actually, having the instant forest, a fast biomass generation that also that is legume, it's very fast to decompose too, and planting become very easy. Then people can just basically broadcast the seed or direct seedling. So the transplanting is not needed like what my rice growing culture in Bali or in Java is needed. Everything need to be looked neat and all of this thing. But in Kalimantan, they don't have to be looked neat. The point is they have to grow. And so we also do with polyculture or horticulture system in the tidal and rain-fed rice field area. So because there's no plowing needed, and the rice field areas are still littered with the tree stumps and everything. So there are some inundated because of depression, natural depression. There they will grow rice. The one that is actually mounded, they will grow all kinds of other needed vegetable like chilies, tomatoes, and all of those things. But at the same time, we also set up apiary trials in the area because of the availability of these pioneering vegetation for the bees. And we also reintroduced the idea of facilitating the inner forest fish migration. The community, Dayak community over there, they see forests as not merely of trees and vegetation. They see forests as actually everything that, you know, this is very classic everywhere in the Amazon, they're also seeing it that way. But in terms of fish aquaculture culture, fish rearing culture in Dayak, it's very sophisticated too, because when I mentioned that people are fishing with fire inside the forest, because the forest, once the tree in the peat falling because of a natural disease, and it will create some pond, and then there is where during the inundation fish will come over there spawning, escaping from the big fish in the main river. So this is where they harvest, and then now they can't go to say it like to the nearest forest, which is the concession area. They will not go there. So, but they still have some land that actually can accommodate the fish migration if they are being designed in a certain way. So, yes, beje is a local word. It's a pond. It's a pond in the middle of the forest where fish migrates over there. And even migration, fish migration, they also have a term for it. So it's just like where the salmon's migrating probably have some term among the American natives over there. So come to the Nagro Forestry to discuss about forest regeneration and much more closer. So a lot of my question that the first time when I see them, I keep on asking the community over there, why don't you grow? Why don't you do agroforestry? What commodity? That is that question. Rubber. What is the price of rubber? And again, when it comes to conservation, there is indigenous rubber called jalutong that you use, that is the main material for your chewing gum. When we ask them, why don't you grow jalutong? Who's going to buy? For what? You know, and how much am I going to earn out of it? And it's always been about, you know, like monoculture way of growing commodities, growing crops over there in agroforestry system. So it's not attractive economically. And a lot of time when we're talking about agroforestry, it's about planting some commodity next to a forest. So they see it like, palm oil is also agroforestry, it's next to my forest. And I go, why don't you do it? I ask them, it's too expensive. And when it's harvesting, and too expensive to start with, and only big company can do that, with the schemes of pyramid schemes involving the community also, at the end, usually about 10 years or 14 years after they started, and then the palm plantation will be given to the community, but it's already very, very less productive. And it costs a lot to start palm oil. It costs a lot to maintain palm oil to be productive. And it doesn't produce much. And every of those, it's very intensive. And post-harvesting market is also a problem. You know, once you have saved palm oil for the sake of it, you harvest palm oil now, and you want to actually sell them to the mill next hour. Half day, the price is already gone by a quarter. A day, gone by half. 3 days, for free. Who would the farmer has the truck to deliver their, you know, each hectare of palm oil could produce up to 10 tons. And nobody will be able to afford it. And say, like, it's not attractive at all. So forget about agroforestry, you know, monoculture agroforestry. So they told me our design, they said that we have a culture of a forest gardening culture. That's what they said, which is true. Again, the forest garden for them, the forest is garden for them. It has all their livestock, including bird, deers, pigs. That is their livestock. When you ask the Dayak, why don't you try to rear some pigs? They're like, why? Because the forest already rear them. And all kinds of other things. So they do have a culture or a technology of gardening the forest. Initially, rattan was very formidable, a very profitable commodity, non-timber commodity from the forest. And again, the government about 10 years ago issuing some policy that actually banning the local people, the Dayak, to export rattan outside of Indonesia, a raw rattan, without being turned into furniture. And the Dayak said, we are not furniture maker people. We are the grower of the rattan. We can grow rattan as well as we could, and we can harvest them and do the post-harvesting, but we're not a weaver for the taste of the global market. But the government basically said, no, you can't export that raw rattan anymore, and that's it. So the rattan trade died. So there's nothing left for the people. So when they manage the forest as a garden, the community actually treat the forest as their automatic teller machine. If they need money, back then we can call it illegal logging, they knew that, oh, okay, I'll cut one of this timber. And when they are doing it manually, a lot of, if you ask people over there, I mean, it's my forest, it's been the forest of my ancestors for a long time, I know how to take care of it, I know how to log this for this particular big tree so it wouldn't damage that tree, because that is my investment for the next time. So they treated this forest actually as a way to get their disposable income. For example, this kid wanted to go to the university, there's one iron wood ready to harvest, they are harvested. So the one good things about the forest garden cultures is when the rattan was there and then the rattan trade was very good, none of this rattan forest, the rattan requires big tree to stand in order to have good quality rattan. Rattan is climbing up. So this is later on probably will be related to vanilla. The rattan need a tree to stand in order to have a good quality rattan. So the community maintains all kinds of trees in the forest for the rattan to lean. So when the rattan was there, there is no fire, because the rattan was very valuable. And one particular rice cultivar is called rattan rice, because the value of the 1 kilo of rattan is equivalent to 1 kilo of rice. That was how good that rice quality back then. And so everybody, the tribes basically aspire to be able to buy their rice rattan. So rattan was very, very, very valuable commodity that helped the forest from engulfed by the fire. So the idea of doing forest gardening by the community is basically now producing some kind of an opinion from the community to say, like, if we're doing the forest gardening again, forest gardening is not only about planting one particular commodity, it will be everything, including the new, that if you have a forest, if you wanted to have all of your livestock coming, make sure that you also grow ficuses. So ficuses, they understand it very well. Ficuses, fruits that by the river or inside the forest actually provided food for all the animal that they will hunt. And especially for a species of bird, the swift, that produces the edible swiftness that fetch a very, very good price at the moment in China. That is basically one of the main industry in the area. Everybody is building up swift houses and constantly looking for the idea of how to increase the swiftness production. But one of the tribe members observed that actually the swift is always circling around the clump area, the riparian area, where usually various ficuses grow. They observed that actually ficuses, which is considered to be one of the keystone species, help to generate a lot more swiftness. So when the ficuses is blooming, they're swift from their houses, just flying back and forth very, very frequently, instead of when there's no ficuses, the swift is gone for the whole day and then come back at night. So this is the tribal observation that basically said, we have to bring back the ficuses. as part of our forest gardening. So if the forest gardening is back, I'm sure that the, you know, like, people will never think about going inside into the deeper area of the forest, because for the local people, going deep into the forest, peat, the local language, the local word for peat, it's called luau. Luau means something low, a low area that only people who knows can venture. So it's a dangerous place to go. It is. It's a dangerous place to go into the peat, especially, you know, in the daytime, and you can basically laugh yourself out because of the gas emissions coming out. And for me, who's not, you know, who doesn't spend a lot of time over there, only a month at the time, I still have a giggle every time that I spend, you know, walking more than 2 kilometers in a peat. At the end of the kilometers. So so based on our understanding of the forest garden, and so I proposed the I proposed to the company that we should set up a demo plot of how to show that that varieties of valuable commodities as well can be grown, as well as helping the forest regeneration. So the site is somewhere over here. So this is a canal that is 7 kilometers long canal. So it took about 2 hours from one end to another end to go. And we have a site somewhere over here, and that's it. So that's the canal. And I will spend there every now and then, but not anymore. I don't work for them anymore. So this is the design that, based on their forest gardening culture, that we came up with together. So it's peat. So this area is, the landscape is peat, and we modifying it a little bit. So every, say it like, if it's a hectare, it's 100 meters, and then every 25 meters there should be a silver fishery, you know, like there should be a beige, an aquaculture that they made. And we ensure with the discussion with the community that we ensure that we have to have a ficuses to grow in the area, to both as food providers, as well as the community also said that the ficuses is one of the best water retenting vegetation in the area. So what about the rest of it? And then the rest can be left as natural as it is, as what we call as a paludiculture system, where all of the pioneering trees and regenerating forest is growing, but they are still producing, for example, the sago can be harvested, and the honey can be harvested, and also the fish are also traveling there. And in some of the area where they are not continuously inundated, you can grow pepper, you can grow vanilla, and you can grow all kinds of other things incorporated into the forest. But this one is the area where you know, from the digging from here a little bit, but these are not connected to the main canal or to the main river. But in during the high tide or rainy season, the water will overflow. Actually, the fish will go that way. And then when the water is receding, the fish cannot go out. I mean, it's a very well-established traditional technique that they know of. So These are the trials, these are the activities that, 13 activities that we are currently, that they are currently doing in relation to agroecology. But I'm just going to give you a glimpse on the Fenila forest and forest regeneration, what we're doing with it. Do I still have time? Just
maybe if you wrap up in the next few minutes,
okay.
Yeah.
So that vanilla is actually growing in the forest. This one is a natural vanilla. I think there are species of albida, Vanilla albida, and then that one over here is introduced by some tribes, chiefs over there. It's the Mexican planifolia, and then actually they can grow really, really well in the settings of, that is the settings of the backgrounds, is a regenerating forest. So the vanilla grows really well, and it's actually blooming. So the question was initially, why nobody was telling us before that vanilla can grow over here? But actually about 30 years ago, one of the chief actually already tried to do it, and it worked. But nobody really endorsing it anymore, because the governments are so busy endorsing palm oil and other big making money. Yep. Jake's already mentioned a little bit of it. So vanilla is an orchid that I wanted to highlight over here. So when the forest is in states of regeneration in the degraded area, one thing that I notice over there is the germination of orchid seed. So when orchid seeds germinated, very exclusively need a mycorrhiza colony to grow. So if vanilla is orchid, then it's probably so suitable to be planted, to be cultivated in a degraded forest. And so it was. And then we did actually lab testing the vanilla that we planted over there, and about 80% of its roots is actually colonized by many different types of mycorrhiza that we cannot we didn't specify because we didn't have much money. But the problem, the question is whether that mycorrhiza in the orchid is actually related to the mycorrhiza that is established in the pioneering trees in the area. I'm sure it is. There is an open room for a proper soil research and peat soil research on that. So it can grow very well. And and in so many areas also there are, you know, old rubber forests from the Dutch era, and they also can be used as a vanilla plantation. So the key is it's so cheap to grow vanilla in the area, because they don't need to plant the standing tree. Like if you go to Madagascar, first thing that they have to do, they have to plant this tree for the orchid to stand. But in the degraded area, there where we already have regenerating forest, we just basically put the vanilla underneath it, and then they'll grow with the forest if you grow it. I'll just show you some pictures. Yes, this is how the vanilla seedling, that this is 2 months ago, I started the major planting. So it's been distributed to the community. It has to go through all kinds of mode of transportation. 2 months, they're already more than 50 centimeters long, an average, from a very short, about 30 centimeters seedling stem, and they grow very fast. And it's probably due to the abundance availability of mycorrhiza that's supporting the fast growing. And this is the forest setting, the regenerating forest setting. So they they grow even better than my background is also a vanilla grower in Bali, and I'm so surprised that actually the vanilla in a peat setting, they grow much faster than the vanilla that I have in a mineral soil setting in Bali. So this is the area nearby by the REDS Plus project, and because it's so difficult to carry on my own speed to grow vanilla with the community over there, so I also find a community near the FAIL Mega Rice project, and we started planting about 18,000 plants over there the last 3 months, and it grows quite well actually. This is an area called Kapuas. A little bit further over there is actually the Mega Rice, FAIL Mega Rice project, and we actually, that is for us, and it's full of vanilla over there, and we have a center and supported by the government officers with the government official locally, with the current policy on forestry in Indonesia is very conducive, so it's much easier right now for the community to gain access to plant the commodity in a designated forest by the government. And the good things that the moving things with this vanilla initiative that we're doing, the women are basically a lot more responsive in taking part. When I ask them why, the men are still in the post-traumatic syndromes of illegal logging, where there is no log to be logged anymore. So basically, like, we can't do anything anymore. We don't know what to do. And instead, what they do is playing cards and smoking. And the woman is just basically like, we've been doing all the things. When you log, I've been working. Now, there's no logging, I will work too. So this is the head of the chief. So he organized all of this planting. This is an abandoned rubber plantation from the Dutch era. And within 3 days, or 6 days, 18,000 plants with 50 women, they just work like speed of light. Because planting vanilla is very easy. You just basically put them under the tree and then cover them slightly with mulch. That's it. But according to the chief, don't employ men to do this. Because I asked him, why? Because more than half of the time they will spend on smoking and chatting. So this is done by the Women Farmers Association. And then at this point, we are in a phase to formalize this association into a cooperative, so we can apply a concession, small concession from the government to plant vanilla in the forest, and that will become a mainstream policy in the Indonesian government to regenerate forests as well as productive. Thank you. So,